The real estate crisis here in the United States may be even worse than it looks. Governments and the media track foreclosures using statistics that they find from a company called RealtyTrack. But it turns out that RealtyTrack does not count foreclosures in hundreds of rural counties, and that gives an impression that there's no foreclosure crisis in rural areas, which there is. Scott Finn of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
79-year-old June Walsalchok is a coal miner's widow who lives in a small, cinderblock house on Sewell Mountain, West Virginia. She remembers the day that a fast-talking mortgage broker convinced her to refinance her home.
He had a whole bunch of papers, and he said, sign here, sign here, sign here. He just said I was getting a loan, and my interest was going to be real low, and my payment was going to be real low.
She didn't read the fine print. Her monthly payments doubled, and the company threatened her with foreclosure. Walsalchok turned for help to a nonprofit law firm called Mountain State Justice, public interest lawyer Bren Pomponio.
The number of people coming to us to help save their homes has steadily increased. It's more than almost we can handle.
Pomponio says he's surprised that, according to RealtyTrack, West Virginia has one of the lowest foreclosure rates in the nation. It turns out RealtyTrack was wrong. A color-coded map on RealtyTrack's website shows huge blank spots in the rural West, Midwest, and South. In fact, the company says it doesn't count foreclosure notices in more than 900 rural counties. That means RealtyTrack's foreclosure rates are way too low for states like South Dakota, Vermont, and West Virginia.
We know we're underreporting West Virginia. We know we're not covering the entire state as thoroughly as we'd like to.
That's Rick Sharga of RealtyTrack. He admits his company only counts a fraction of rural foreclosures across the country. He says RealtyTrack's first priority is large urban areas.
If I miss a county in California, I'm going to miss more in a month than I would miss in West Virginia for the whole year.
In West Virginia last year, RealtyTrack counted fewer than 500 foreclosure notices. But a new federal count shows more than 12,000 notices in the state since the beginning of last year. And it's not just a West Virginia problem. 8 of the 10 most rural states also make RealtyTrack's list of the 10 states with the lowest foreclosure rate. West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller believes rural states are being ignored.
It's ridiculous. It's embarrassing. It's stupid. I'm going to fight to make sure that we have accurate information and that everybody, they get counted.
Rockefeller co-sponsored the Foreclosure Prevention Act, which Congress passed in July. The bill required the Department of Housing and Urban Development to measure foreclosure rates in each state. On HUD's new list, rural states have significantly higher foreclosure rates. For example, RealtyTrack ranks Mississippi near the bottom, while HUD says it's in the top 10. This matters because lawmakers depend on RealtyTrack's numbers. In West Virginia, a predatory lending bill was killed after legislators saw RealtyTrack's low rankings. Again, Bren Pomponio of Mountain State Justice.
They were led to believe that West Virginia was unique and there wasn't a big problem here when that wasn't the case. And so nothing ever got done.
HUD has only agreed to count foreclosures this one time. Senator Rockefeller wants to force the government to continue tracking foreclosures and not rely on incomplete numbers from companies like RealtyTrack. For NPR News, I'm Scott Finn in Charleston, West Virginia.
I'm looking here at a map of rural areas overlooked by mainstream foreclosure studies, and you can look at it too by going to our website, npr.org. And now here's an update on the bank that's been buying when others have been selling. Bank of America has grabbed the assets of failing institutions. Now the giant company has announced disappointing earnings. It cut its dividend as part of an effort to raise some capital.
At the same time, Bank of America offered some promising news for homeowners. The company struck a deal with regulators, and the agreement means many people will find it easier to pay their mortgages. Here's NPR's Chris Arnold.
The move by Bank of America comes as part of a settlement with state prosecutors. They had sued the mortgage giant Countrywide Financial for predatory lending. Bank of America now owns Countrywide, and in settling the litigation, B of A has agreed to make loans more affordable for some 400,000 homeowners. Lisa Madigan is the Attorney General of Illinois, who brought one of the suits against Countrywide.
It's the first ever in the country mandatory loan modification program. So it will require Bank of America to modify loans that Countrywide borrowers got into that were very risky and unfair loans.
If someone who makes $30,000 a year bought a million-dollar home, the settlement's not going to help them. But there are a lot of people in danger of foreclosure who could afford to stay in their homes if they had lower interest rates and or a somewhat lower loan amount. So B of A has agreed to drop rates as low as 2.5% for some borrowers and to forgive some debt. And it will suspend foreclosures while it looks at who can qualify.
This is a huge deal. This is a watershed moment.
Mark Pierce is North Carolina's Deputy Commissioner of Banks. Now, you may not like the sound of giving people who made mistakes super low interest rates, but those rates will adjust back to market levels in coming years. And Pierce says it's in everybody's interest to try to stop this tsunami of foreclosures. It's driving down home prices and hurting the entire economy.
We won't get out of the financial crisis we're in until we're able to stop the bleeding on foreclosures. Instead of addressing that problem, we allowed it to fester. And it has festered and now infected the whole of our global financial economy.
Pierce says restructuring people's loans can stop that bleeding, but he says the industry before this settlement has not done these so-called loan workouts in any kind of large-scale way, and that's a huge problem.
8 out of 10 families with subprime and Alt-A loans are not getting any assistance at all when they struggle to make their mortgage payment. So there are just a lot of people that are falling through the cracks.
A senior manager at one of the major mortgage companies tells NPR that at that firm, maybe 1 in 100 people facing foreclosure are getting any kind of reasonable loan workout offer. Bank of America manages more home loans than any other company, so this deal could mark a major shift here. Terry Francisco is a Bank of America spokesman.
The scale of this is very unprecedented, and certainly the experience we've had over the past year has lent itself to this, and so therefore we can step up significantly the efforts we've had in the past to keep homeowners in their homes.
One problem has been that even when lenders do a workout, it doesn't go far enough to actually make the loan affordable. So here, B of A is aiming to reduce payments for borrowers to make them just a third of the borrower's income. Still, some housing advocates are skeptical.
It is a step in the right direction, but it's not as big a step as one might think.
Bruce Marks heads up the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. He says all the numbers sound good, but he's concerned that B of A has the option here of putting homeowners into interest-only loans in order to reduce their payments. That means homeowners could still owe more than their house is worth and won't have much incentive to keep it.
People will walk. The only way people will stay in a property that's worth less than what you owe is to make it a fixed-rate, fully amortizing loan so people are invested in the property over the long term. That's true home ownership.
Still, the agreement clearly goes a lot further than anything the industry has done before. Prosecutors would like it to be a model for other companies. Meanwhile, Bank of America is feeling the pain like many other banks. B of A announced earnings yesterday that were much worse than expected. Its profits were down 68%, in part due to the same kind of problem loans it's trying to sort out here. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Here's another sign that the credit crisis is spreading. In the last couple of weeks, interest rates have quadrupled on the bonds that nonprofits use to pay for buildings and projects. Now hospitals, colleges, and other organizations are warning that if the credit freeze doesn't thaw soon, they'll have to cut staff and services to make up their growing debt payments. From member station WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
It looks like business as usual at Endicott College, a small liberal arts school north of Boston. Sophomore Chris Gugino is giving a campus tour.
You guys all seniors this year? Excellent. So when you begin the application process...
Gugino may be playing Joe College cool, but just inside the administration building, Vice President for Finance Lynn O'Toole is stressed. Where to house those future students? Dorm space is tight, and the college wants to build more. That is, she says, until the credit crisis suddenly drove the interest rate for new construction bonds through the roof.
Well, last week it was 5.95%, and I thought that was bad. 7.2% is...
O'Toole trails off. Just a couple of weeks ago, it was under 2%. Next summer's groundbreaking is now in doubt.
At this point, we're rethinking. We are looking at the options. The residence hall is something that we desperately need, but on the other hand, the cost of debt is just prohibitive for us.
The sudden jump is also ratcheting up the payments that nonprofits owe for the bonds they've already taken out.
When it went from 1.75 to 5 point something, it was not a good day. I mean, it cost us $12,000 that day.
Ken Hamburg is in charge of finances for the Home for Little Wanderers. That's a child welfare nonprofit that holds over $3 million in these bonds. If the interest rate stays around 7%, Hamburg's organization will have to come up with another $180,000 this year.
The problem with the current situation is that it comes back to haunt the clients that we serve. We serve kids who have been abused or neglected. Every dollar that has to be transferred someplace else, like to pay debt, is not pleasant for us.
It's unpleasant across the country. Some institutions have been able to lock in fixed interest rates, but now the investment banks that handle those deals are on the ropes. Nonprofits are scrambling to pay the sudden costs in the middle of a budget year.
Some institutions have hundreds of millions of dollars in variable rate exposure. In dollar terms, we're talking about a lot of money.
That's Ben Caswell, the head of the Massachusetts Health and Educational Facilities Authority. It helps issue these bonds to places like Harvard University, Boston's Children's Hospital, and Fine Arts Museum. He hopes the government's $700 billion rescue will get cash flowing again.
Until that money works its way back into the credit markets and the debt markets, the tight credit is going to persist, and we're going to continue to see these high rates.
That would have a lasting negative impact on hospitals and universities, and therefore the overall economy, says Lynn O'Toole of Endicott College.
We're a microcosm of what is out there for the rest of the country. So if this impacts us, it's also going to impact the people that we hire, that we use for our construction projects. It's going to ripple on down.
O'Toole hopes the rescue plan will give a boost to the credit markets and bring her college's capital costs back down. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
Decades of war in Afghanistan left a visible mark on its people. Tens of thousands of Afghans lost their legs to landmines. Most make a living by begging. But one group of these mine survivors, as the United Nations calls them, has come up with another way to feed their families. They created a bicycle messenger service in Kabul. NPR's Saraya Sarhadi Nelson joined them on one of their recent rounds.
In this Kabul park that he calls his office, Afghan bicycle messenger Amin Zaki hands out documents to be delivered on this morning. Fellow bicycle messenger Abdul Sabur tells his colleagues where they'll be working. Normally, the messengers would also divide up pizza delivery duty. But as it's the holy fasting month of Ramadan, the work on this day is limited to documents. A few minutes later, the messengers get up off the grass and walk to their bikes. One is on crutches, and the others are limping. Each of these men has only one leg. Not that they see the loss of the other one as a problem in their line of work. Like Abdul Khalil, who had his right leg amputated after stepping on a mine 7 years ago. Khalil kicks the kickstand up with his left foot. He then swings his prosthetic leg over the bicycle and climbs on. He rides onto the street, carrying an old messenger bag held together by masking tape. Khalil glides easily among the cars and motorcycles that seem to follow no traffic rules on Kabul's crazy streets. He says it's as easy to pedal with his prosthetic leg as his real one. Khalil has worked for the disabled cycle messenger services for nearly 6 years. He says it's allowed him to feed, clothe, and school his 8 children. At the UN Mine Action Center for Afghanistan, Deputy Program Director Susan Helseth says she's happy with the messenger's work. Hers is one of a few foreign agencies that employ the messengers, who charge $1 for most deliveries.
The messenger service, I'm positive, has cut down on the use of our vehicles, has cut down on our fuel consumption, and it also has provided employment for these guys that ride around for us.
She says the bicycle messengers are more reliable, too, unimpeded by the growing number of vehicles that grind traffic to a halt here.
And so we feel quite confident in the service and think that other UN agencies and NGOs and commercial companies should be using this. It would probably cut down the number of cars running around Kabul and maybe help with the traffic and even the accident situations.
But Amin Zaki, who manages the messenger service, says the men have had a hard time getting clients since splitting last year from their parent group, the Afghan Amputee Bicyclists for Rehabilitation and Recreation. Zaki says they left at the urging of their German donor group, which was unhappy with the Afghan parent agency for keeping money it was supposed to spend on the bicycle messengers. Both the donor and former parent agency declined to comment for the story. Zaki says with too little work, they fell behind on the rent. They were evicted from their office last Friday and have since met in the park. His colleague, Abdul Sabur, says with the weather turning, they won't be able to meet there for long. He doesn't know what they'll do if their business fails, but he says one thing's for sure. He would rather die than have to go out and beg. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.
Almost 100 days ago, Dr. Wayne Clough was given charge of Judy Garland's ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz, and the space shuttle Enterprise, also a couple bald eagles, living, and dinosaurs, fossilized. Clough is the new secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. It's a place that has been in the news for all the wrong reasons. Clough's job is to change that. On this morning, he's standing on a balcony in the Natural History Museum's cavernous entrance hall. He's looking down on Henry, the iconic elephant that stands with ears flared and trunk raised, greeting millions of visitors every year. You can hear Henry and other animals from all over the world.
You'll hear lions and you'll hear hyenas and baboons and others make noises to intrigue the young people who come in and for them to understand that these are living species. And that's really what the story is about, the living species and the future. It is about the past to some extent. We have fossils here, but the past is about the future.
Dr. Clough is here to ensure the Smithsonian's future. He recently stood on this balcony above a crowd of 1,500, and he delivered a speech for the grand opening of the Natural History Museum's new Ocean Hall.
You sort of felt like Eva Peron. I was ready to break out in song.
Like Evita, Clough is overseeing a huge dominion in turmoil. Nearly 30 museums, galleries, and research centers spread out over thousands of miles. The Smithsonian's last secretary left in scandal over his lavish spending. Clough is here to bring reform on every level. Ethics, fundraising, research and education. Until last year, he was president of Georgia Tech. People credit him with vastly expanding the school's budget and boosting its academic standards. When he moved to Washington over the summer and started wandering through these exhibits, people didn't recognize him at first. He says he was a little intimidated.
Realizing that here is this magnificent resource, struggling a bit with some of the issues that it faces, and suddenly that I have a huge responsibility to help. It's truly exciting. At this stage of my life, to have another opportunity to make a contribution to an institution that is so central to our country and so important to our country and its future.
Why do this at this stage in your life? Your kids are in Atlanta. You grew up in Georgia. You had a successful tenure at Georgia Tech. You take a place that has had serious struggles financially, ethically. Why do this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a civil engineer, and civil engineers build things. And I've always worked on big infrastructure project. It's building an institution as opposed to building infrastructure. And institutions are extremely important. There are very few institutions that survive in countries. And this one, if we're lucky, will be here 1,000 years from now. And what I would hope people will say, 500 or 1,000 years from now, those people in 2008 got their act together. They didn't mess it up.
Pulled it back from the brink.
Right, yeah. And so I think that's our job.
When we first found Clough, the museum was not yet open. He was exploring the Hall of Minerals. He stood a few steps from the Hope Diamond. On one side of him, a sensuous bulbous sandstone formation slowly turned on a pillar. On the other side, a huge jagged piece of space rock.
This tells the story of that we are in a universe, and geology is about that universe, as well as our world, as well as our country.
So do you see Smithsonian primarily as a collection of museums, or as a research center, or as an education facility, or something different altogether?
All those together. It is all those things.
Do you think Smithsonian needs to favor one of those over the others in order to stay thriving and relevant, particularly when money is hard to come by?
Yeah, and that's part of the planning process. We obviously have to have some focus. We can't just collect things willy-nilly. We need to be focused on what we want to preserve, and I think we need to be careful about that because we can't continue to store so much. It's getting to be a big problem for us to take care of the things that we have, and we understand that.
Where does the money come from?
Well, partly from the federal government.
But Senator Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the committee that oversees Smithsonian funding, has basically said, don't come to us, we're strapped as it is for cash.
Sure. Yeah. I think Senator Feinstein is saying, get out there and raise some private money. Get out there and find other ways to raise funding, and we are doing that.
As you look for private sources of funding, how do you avoid pitfalls? For example, there was an oil company that offered to fund an oceans exhibit, yep. And the gift ended up being rescinded because appearances were not very good.
Right. Correct. Well, there's always that tension. I mean, every time you approach a donor, you have to ask yourself that question. Is this a good fit for the institution? Is this the right place to go? Are there issues that might arise? And you may conclude fairly early in the game that there is not a good fit, and you should not continue the discussions towards that particular gift. We always say that raising money is a contact sport and a team sport. It takes a lot of visits, and it doesn't happen overnight.
Tough time to be raising money.
Yeah. Well, but the way the whole thing works is, for example, our foundations in this country have to give away 5% of their revenues every year. And so that's there. Now, it may not be as much as it was because their endowments have gone down, but at the same time, they're giving it away. And we want to say the Smithsonian is a great place for you to invest.
The Smithsonian needs to raise $2.5 billion over the next 10 years. And that's just for maintenance and upkeep. It does not include new construction, like the planned African American Museum. And at the same time, the Smithsonian is trying to evolve. When the organization was established more than 160 years ago, there were no cable TV science channels. There was no internet. And Dr. Clough, who was born in the early 1940s, is not exactly a child of Google.
We need to reach out as opposed to simply hope that people will come into our museum complexes. And I think the more we reach out, the more people want to come see the real deal. So we're going to get a group together early in the year where we have young people coming in who are experts on Wikipedia, who are experts on gaming and all these things. And then we'll have some of our curators on the other side, and we'll talk about how do we actually reach out and use this to connect to a generation that probably may not know a lot about the Smithsonian. You can find out new things. For example, the Smithsonian American Art Museum now is involved with a Twitter site, which I didn't know much about Twitter, but I gone on the other day, and I Twittered a little bit, which was really fun. But it's a way to bring people in to actually engage with our curators.
Clough oversees more than 100 million beautiful, priceless, and rare artifacts. But when I asked him to name his favorite thing in the Smithsonian's collections, he described something completely intangible. It's a warehouse where scientists are studying endangered languages. Like Clough, those men and women are trying to make sure historic wells of knowledge don't dry up. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops, that's where you.
On Election Day, millions of people will be casting ballots for the first time and may not know all the rules. Supporters of Barack Obama have been emailing and text messaging people about what not to wear to the polls. In some states, if people show up at the polls with a candidate's name on a T-shirt or a hat, they could have a problem. From member station WHQR, Catherine Welch reports.
The elections office in Horry County, South Carolina, bustles as people stream in on one of the last days to register to vote. Elections manager Lynn Marlowe says if one of these new voters tries to cast a ballot wearing a political hat, button, or T-shirt, they will be asked to take it off or cover it up.
Some of the managers there will take a jacket for the people to use if they're coming in to vote, and they'll let them put that jacket on before they go to vote. If not, they have to turn, if it's a shirt, turn it inside outwards.
This South Carolina law has been in effect for more than 40 years. It requires poll workers to keep political displays at least 200 feet away from the voting booth. Marlowe says nobody's ever put up a stink, Southern manners perhaps. But down the street at Bernie's Cafe in Conway, South Carolina, Becky Smith scoffs at the notion.
Think of all those T-shirts they've sold. You see them everywhere online, the Obama and the Palin T-shirts. I wonder how many people are going to have to disrobe before they vote.
At the next table over, Cheryl Locke listens in and butts into the conversation. She happens to be a poll worker and puts down her cheeseburger to defend the law.
I think people have plenty of freedom of speech, but the poll should be a neutral place. Otherwise, you have people in there that would be politicking. It would create chaos.
Pennsylvania, a battleground state, still hasn't resolved what voters can wear at the polls. New York and Vermont have banned political items outright. Some California counties will solve the problem by handing out paper smocks. Kentucky says people can wear whatever they want at the polls as long as they're not a walking political billboard.
There's an awful lot of latitude for the states to interpret what is free speech within a polling station.
University of Florida political scientist Daniel Smith says there's a heightened awareness of these laws this election.
I think there's a partisanship to this with respect to the dampening effect that such laws may have. It may be intimidating to new voters who may want to be wearing a shirt proudly for a candidate, but then be told that they can't do so and vote.
And since there's such a mishmash of states and exceptions, Smith expects the issue to linger on into future elections. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch.
There's no reason for your confusion to linger even into this election, and we want to help. If you are confused about the elections laws where you are, just send us your questions to this address, morning@npr.org. Put in the subject line, voting questions, and we're going to try to provide some answers to you later this week right on the program.